Hello, you're listening to a podcast of the Ciceronian Society called The Sower. The Ciceronian Society equips and encourages Christian scholars to serve the church as a center of cultural and civic renewal. I'm Josh Bowman, Executive Director of the Ciceronian Society. Before we get started, please join me in prayer. In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, we pray, O Lord, that you would bless our conversation and that all we say and do would bring glory and honor to you. Amen. This is a special episode to share more about our upcoming conference and to encourage you to consider proposing a paper and or registering for the 2026 event. We are specifically headed to the campus of Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, March 12th through the 14th, which is a Thursday through a Sunday. I'll share some information and ideas for that event, and we'll hear from one of our conference hosts, the Menard Family Center for Economic Inquiry at Creighton University. As of this recording in July 2025, I'm expecting that we'll likely begin on Thursday morning or early afternoon and go through the end of the day on Saturday. Registration is now open for members and non-members alike, and information regarding lodging and transportation can be found on our website. Unlike the last few events, attendees should not need to rent a car for this conference. And please note that we will not have on-site and prorated registration available. Those will not be available. There will be an attendance cap, and you'll want to register in advance. Sponsorships are available at various levels, so take a look at those. And fellowships will also be available again this year, and we'll have more information on those fellowships specifically in the fall of 2025. So why would someone want to attend the Ciceronian Society Conference? One of our board members said it well. We are the kind of group that takes our faith and scholarship seriously, but we do not take ourselves seriously. If that is a description that matches you, or if it's one you aspire to, I think you'll enjoy your time with us. We're not, strictly speaking, a professional organization focusing on one particular field. We're also not a Cicero or Roman studies organization, although we enthusiastically encourage such work. We are unapologetically Christian and include Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox believers, but the conference is open to all, regardless of one's faith. Most of the people at our conference are Christian faculty and graduate students from many different institutions in the humanities and social sciences, but we also welcome clergy, classical educators, undergraduates, publishers, lawyers, nonprofit and ministry leaders, independent scholars, and really anyone who shares our interest in tradition, place, and things divine. Our organization is not restricted to any particular profession, academic discipline, or education level. That said, I guess if you hate Christians, dislike reading and asking questions, or if you find laughter distasteful, well, why are you listening to this podcast? It should be said, though, that there are many professional benefits to attending an event like this. Quite a few people have met their next employer or employees at a Ciceronian Society conference, and many more have found publishing and collaboration opportunities. It really is an uncommonly fruitful space for developing intellectual and professional friendships with the kinds of people you genuinely want to work with and for. And of course, if you're a presenter, you have the opportunity to receive feedback on your scholarly work from friendly, intelligent people. Oh, and if you hope to be a member of the Ciceronian Society someday, coming to our conference and getting to know us is a great idea. Speaking of presentations and proposals, there's a lot of information on our website about this, including possible topics in various formats. But I want to reiterate a few things here. First, your current professional or educational status has no bearing on whether you can propose something. To be sure, we take scholarly rigor seriously, but we know that such qualities are not restricted to PhDs and professors. Most presentations are driven by some academic research question or thesis, but others are guided by some argument for a particular perspective or for a reading of a particular text or situation. Some presenters may discuss a strategy or pedagogy in education, writing, homeschooling, politics, or even farming and gardening. We may have roundtables discussing a newly published book, or we're seeking to glean wisdom from seasoned veterans of a particular field. Panels may discuss and respond to recent court cases or legislation or major movements and trends in education, ministry, art, popular culture, agriculture, community development, public policy, leadership. Our core themes remain tradition, place, and things divine, and papers examining the subject of place, by the way, will also be considered for our annual Batchelder Prize, so take a look at that. But in 2026, we will be leaning into that 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. Like Cicero and the Roman Republic, we love our country, warts and all, and we want to celebrate and discuss the traditions, places, and faith of America and its people. This focus may lend itself to any number of topics, celebrating, exploring, and critiquing American politics, history, literature, art, culture, music, film, society, philosophy, architecture, economics, theology, education, public policy, and more. We also invite reflections on American religious history and, in the spirit of Russell Kirk's book, Roots of American Order, the way in which the classical and Christian traditions influence the formation of America and the founding generation. Finally, and related to this, if you know of a great book recently published related to the American founding era, consider nominating it for the 2026 Herbert J. Storing Prize, and more information on that is also on the website. As mentioned earlier, for the 2026 Ciceronian Society Conference, we are headed to Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, and one reason for that is due to our friends at the Menard Family Center for Economic Inquiry at Creighton University. To learn more about that center, I am joined today by Dr. Colin O'Reilly and Michael D. Thomas. Colin O'Reilly received his PhD in economics from Suffolk University in 2014. Currently, he is an associate professor of economics at Creighton University and is the director of the Menard Family Center for Economic Inquiry. He is also editor-in-chief of the Journal of Regulatory Economics. Colin's research focuses on institutions that promote economic development. In addition, he has published on the impacts of regulation on the distribution of income and entrepreneurship. His articles have also appeared in peer-reviewed journals, including Public Choice, Economica, and World Development. Michael D. Thomas is an associate professor of economics and finance at Creighton, with a PhD in economics from George Mason University. Dr. Thomas specializes in public choice, welfare economics, and regulatory policy. Michael has contributed extensively to leading academic journals, including Public Choice, Kyklos, I think I said that right, Independent Review, Journal of Private Enterprise, and Review of Austrian Economics. His research incorporates themes from economics, psychology, law, and regulation. Michael's published works focus on behavioral symmetry, which is namely that motivations and incentives are similar in rent-seeking and profit-seeking behavior, as well as the subject of what he calls humanomics, which is basically the notion that economic choosers have complex motivations, and we need to appreciate that and account for it. And he also studies the unintended consequences of taxation and regulation. Dr. Thomas is affiliated with this Menard Center, and he is married to Dr. Diana Thomas, a professor of economics at Creighton as well. Outside of academia, he likes to take long walks with his four kids, participate in his parish, and watch Alabama football. Gross. All right. Well, last year in 2024, he completed 500 miles on the Camino de Santiago de Compostela, and I encourage you to ask him about that when you see him at our conference. All right. With that, Michael and Colin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I have two objectives today. First, I want to give you guys a chance to talk about your center, the Menard Center, the Menard Family Center for Economic Inquiry, and the program you're involved in. And then second, I want to talk about Omaha and what attendees to our 2026 conference can expect. So what is the Menard Family Center for Economic Inquiry, and how did it get started? What are some of your goals and activities?
Yeah, so we were originally founded in 2014 with the generous support of a local donor and her partners, and you know, we've continued to conduct our programming here at Creighton. You know, since then, we've had a really great, you know, 10 or 11 years doing that. The Menard family jumped in 2020 to allow us to continue our programming. And we're really, you know, focused on engaging and serving our community here at Creighton University through open inquiry. And we try to prioritize economics. A lot of us are economists, but also ethics and entrepreneurship, which we think sort of ties in both to our original mission, to our business school. We're housed within the business school here, the Hyder College of Business, but also to you know, some of our business ethicists and you know, philosophers that we also engage with. So we're interdisciplinary in that regard. We engage with undergraduates for the most part. You know, our student population here, you know, our economics degree, for example, is all undergraduates. Our business school, though it does have, you know, graduate programs, is mostly undergraduates. And we engage with them through Socratic style reading groups, through undergraduate research, where faculty members pair up with undergraduate students to pursue research, and through speakers that we bring in to campus to give talks, to engage in weekend reading groups or weekend colloquiums. And we've had a lot of success, I think, connecting to students that are really looking for a little bit more than their coursework. You know, students that are motivated, that are engaged to take that extra step and go beyond the classroom because they're interested. You know, I think are lucky that we're able to have the center here at Creighton. You know, as a Catholic institution, you know, the culture here at Creighton, I think, has really allowed us to, you know, integrate some of our center's mission in terms of concerns for human dignity and agency, and exchange, and allows us to, you know, pursue our mission, which is, you know, interested in studying markets and studying how markets connect to human flourishing. So we've had a lot of success on that front.
Interesting. Now I remember, you know, this tradition of open inquiry. I like the interdisciplinarity, and I think that matches well with what we at the Ciceronian Society are trying to do. And I'm encouraged by, you know, you already answered this, you know, how does it fit into the overall vision of Creighton as a Catholic institution, which is so important. But one of the things I remember as an undergrad, meeting other Christians. And this was at a charismatic evangelical school, viewed economics not simply as the dismal science, but as actually immoral. So it's kind of how I that's not that was not my view, but it was certainly the view of classmates, because economics was viewed, and again, I know that the Menard Center is more than this, but the economics being this major focus. Economics was viewed, though, in my experience, as a kind of means for exploitation of other people and the environment, as well as a kind of, for lack of a better word, operationalization or instrumentalization of greed. I don't even know if those words work, but and this is that's again, that's not my view, but you know, with that Catholic worldview or imagination in mind, and in the context of Creighton, how do you view your vocation as both of you, how do you view your vocation as an economist at a and as a Catholic specifically, and at a Catholic institution?
Well, I'll jump in on there, Colin. This is Michael. Yeah, Josh, everything you're saying resonates, right? So, you know, it's the sort of Gordon Gekko view of economics, right?
Right, yeah.
So whenever people think of economics, they think greed is good or something like this. And I think when we first got here in 2014, we had some of that pushback, and we really tried to, you know, invite people in to have them see what we're doing. And then one of the ways that by 2017 we had developed a program where we got together with other schools like Lindenwood University in St. Louis and St. Louis University, and really tried to build a coalition across different sort of perspectives and ideologies to bring people together and talk about this stuff. And we've centered this on sort of Protestant views on poverty, Catholic views on poverty, and economic views on poverty. And so we engaged like this triple balanced approach and brought in a bunch of people to talk about it from different perspectives. We had people from theology, we had people from philosophy, people from different universities that are engaged in this. And then from that, we really got encouraged by the Acton Institute, which supported our second year of doing that symposium, and really just broadened out a bunch of things. So just by confronting those things head on, we kind of built a culture and community around here by being willing to represent what the side of the economic argument was, while still really bringing some substance to the other part of that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, just to speak to your original, you know, point there, that a lot of people are coming in the door, you know, with a real skepticism, that really view economics as, you know, that cold, calculating, discipline that is really devoid of any kind of human dimension to it. So, you know, it's not uncommon, I think, to, you know, have a freshman come in, or even to interact with colleagues, you know, in universities or at conferences that still have that view of economics. And I think that it takes a conversation with them That can be rewarding, I think, that to be able to have a conversation and say, yeah, I understand your concerns. They're valid concerns with the field, but there's some folks that are trying to do this a little bit differently.
All right, so well, just kind of building off that, I actually want to go back to something Michael said earlier. I was interested to hear you said you teach on the Protestant view of poverty, the Catholic view of poverty, and the economic view of poverty. Is that what you said?
Those were the three different camps we were trying to represent when we were selecting readings and bringing in people to sort of engage critically.
That's interesting. What I'm, if I was, if I saw that on a syllabus, I'd be surprised. I guess in some ways, because on the one hand, I can already see, some differences there, but I immediately think of all the similarities, which I'm sure is, they're there. When you're drawing out those distinctions, what particularly distinguishes those three camps, if you will? I thought that was an interesting way to frame it.
Yeah, so I think it's been a few years. So we started this in 2017, but when I'm thinking back, what one of the major differences was the way that the Protestants thought about all of this is to they brought up an element of sort of personal responsibility and sort of incentives in a community, sort of building the tools necessary to build the work ethic and all of these other things that individuals needed in order to get out of poverty. The Catholics, so I was raised Protestant, so I became Catholic later. What stood out to me about the Catholic social teaching was how community-based it was, how everything was sort of a different unit of analysis for thinking about groups and how we build out groups and how people aren't really responsible for their individual sort of action in the same way, right? Obviously, you can't get away from that, but in the same way, there was an emphasis on the community. And then the economists are always just cutting through with a lens of efficiency, right? So let's not get too interested in emotional appeals, what works, what's the evidence. When we do this, what are the unintended consequences? Where do, our ideas about charity really mess up when we try to apply them? And so a basic mistrust or a undermining of these more motivational issues and just cause and effect analysis. So there's a lot of room for contest and disagreement within that framework.
There's a lot of room for disagreement. I what strikes me is interesting is given what you just said, because I would agree with those distinctions, that they're not, how do I say this, necessary distinctions, right? So that emphasis on community, I never thought of this before, but the emphasis on community in the Catholic context and the kind of more individualistic nature of Protestantism, is at least I'll, again, as a Protestant, I suppose I'll quote unquote defend Protestantism. But it's also in some ways by saying that you're right. But it's not necessarily a necessary condition of Protestantism, right? In the sense that if we had a more robust ecclesiology, the way Catholics do, that we'd have a sense of this kind of, the parish model, the community model of that poverty is not simply a, well, you're a slacker. Right, it's just a misunderstanding of the situation that more that Catholic tradition can be embraced by the Protestant tradition when we think about poverty. And again, we could get off on a tangent here, but is that do you find that to be the case, that essentially as you're studying this, there are these points where Protestant, Catholic, and economic viewpoints converge?
It's all in the same ballpark. They're just a different emphasis. So, the way I'm describing it, or at least the way that I'm thinking about it, is that the Protestants trying to set the individual chooser up with the right circumstances, right? But thinking of that unit of analysis as at the individual level is probably a much easier bridge to cross to economics than it does, that it would be from this communitarian perspective.
Right. Okay. Okay. That's interesting. Actually, Adam Smith, was he Catholic or Protestant? He was Anglican, right? Or Presbyterian?
He's a pretty solid Calvinist in his theology, I believe.
Okay. I've never really thought to ask that question, to be honest with you. That's interesting. I mean, in thinking about most economists, religiously, I would imagine that the early ones or at least thinking of the late 18th through the 19th century. Are they generally Protestants and or some version of that, or like Unitarians and others? Is there a religious history of economics? I mean, is that a thing?
Oh, you're getting into some very interesting territory. So I probably would be speculating too much to nail that down, but I'm very interested in it. It's a longer term project that I'm trying to sort all this stuff out.
Interesting, interesting.
But
What's the joke that I've heard? I can't. Someone said, if you're an economist, you're either an atheist, an Austrian, or a what's the third one? Like the three A's. You guys know what I'm talking about? It's like an atheist, an Austrian, or a I can't remember what it was. There's another one. I can't remember. Someone put it in the comments. That'll be good for our
Yeah, we're
algorithm.
gonna have to look that one up.
Well, let's. I mean, we could go on a tangent here, and again, y'all just sparked my interest, and I could go into this conversation for a while. And I know that that's the kind of open inquiry that the Menard Center is going after. But I want to shift briefly now to just talk about Omaha, because we are headed to Omaha again, March 12th through the 14th, 2026, for our conference, and plenty of people have said what. Why did you make that decision? It's not a city that everyone's thinking about, right? Unless you're in the meatpacking industry, or you're a what's it called? Berkshire Hathaway shareholder. I'm just curious. I'd like us to learn more about Omaha. But how long have you each been there? And how, when people ask about it, how do you describe Omaha to them?
Yeah, I mean, I've been here for 9 years now. Michael's been here for a little longer than that, but I grew up in Massachusetts, and so yeah, I get that question about that a lot of why Omaha? Well, Omaha's it's a pretty good sized city. I think that it's got a lot to offer without a lot of the downside of being in a really big city. And so I think that you mentioned some of the bigger events that happen here, Berkshire Hathaway, also the College World Series. We just had the College World Series here. Which is in Omaha every year, which is a lot of fun. And we actually through the center host a kind of summer manuscript workshop every year, and go to a College World Series game after, which is a lot of fun. Helps people connect with the city. And to kind of go back to your previous question about or previous comment about Adam Smith, mini conference that we did, manuscript workshop, was about humanomics, and Michael can give a little bit more context on that, which is some of the programming that our center's moved towards over the years in terms of trying to integrate, the work of Adam Smith with a more humane economics that considers, a wider array of perspectives than your standard kind of utility maximization that we get. But your question was about Omaha, and I think that it's a very livable city. You've got a lot to offer here, both in terms of enough good food and restaurants and things like that, enough big events with Berkshire Hathaway and things like that. Our zoo is excellent. People say that it's sort of on par with the San Francisco Zoo. So there's a lot to offer here, but it still preserves some of that community that I think you might lose in a bigger city. I'm sure Michael's got some thoughts. He's been here longer than I have.
Oh, we definitely have to take you to a steak restaurant. I've got a couple in mind. There's a, you know, they're really nice places to go. There's some places that are well represented in big cities around the country, but then there are also some little local places that very much feel like a 1970s steakhouse. So if you're interested in steakhouse culture, this is a great place to go out. But a little known claim that Omaha makes is that they are one of two cities that claims to have originated the Reuben sandwich, the other, of course, being New York. It's just a sort of a character thing that Omaha pulled that flex and has a whole story about a Reuben, but they're quite good. So you have to try that Reuben sandwich when you're out here.
It certainly seems like a very quintessential Midwestern city in some ways. And historically, if I'm not mistaken, right, this is Omaha is where kind of starts out as a trading post. Of course, the Omaha Indians, what it's named after, starts as a trading post, and then eventually it's known not only for its meat packing, but also because it becomes a not a terminus, the starting point, right, for the Transcontinental Railroad. Is that
That's
right?
right.
Yeah.
So Lincoln got to pick where the starting point was going to be. And I think he might have actually bought some land as well, somewhere around there. And then, so that's Council Bluffs. And so Omaha was the sort of unincorporated territory across from Council Bluffs. And so a bunch of wild history from the early years of Omaha. But you're right. The Lakota Sioux are in the area, the Omaha tribe, and a whole bunch of influence from that history as well. But the Creighton brothers, whose widows used their fortune to found a school and a dentistry school, were the original donations that started Creighton. They had the right to run telegraph wire along the Transcontinental Railroad. So that's how they got their wealth, and that's how they influenced Omaha.
And
Why?
that railroad history is, still here. There's two sort of beautiful train stations right downtown. One of them houses the Durham Museum, which you could check out if you're in town. Kind of history, a little bit of a kids focus there, but beautiful building, even if you just walk by it. And Union Pacific is still headquartered here in Omaha and is, an employer of a lot of our students will get internships there as they come out the door.
Yeah, I'm curious about going back to the steak culture, right? The steakhouse culture, and Omaha's role in that. Why on earth? I mean, you think about cattle. I think Texas, it's certainly big in the Dakotas and Oklahoma, other places like that. Why on earth is Oklahoma, I mean, not Oklahoma, Omaha, this kind of center of the meatpacking industry, or at least well, I think it still is, right? Just from an economic standpoint, why did that happen? Do we know?
You've got Kansas City, you've got Chicago, both big, places where they would aggregate and slaughter. But Omaha is one of those other ones, and Omaha survived a little bit longer. The whole south part of the city, I've seen pictures, was slaughterhouses, and it's, even today it's sort of distinctively laid out to accommodate railroad tracks that are no longer there that would have sort of been aggregating all of the pieces. It used to be a lot more sensible to do the slaughtering at this sort of decentralized system at these railroad hubs. So Omaha was one of those.
I see. Thinking about, we mentioned the zoo, which I've heard again, as you all have said, I've heard it's world class. The Durham Museum you mentioned. What are some other kind of, especially for the nerds among us, if you will, coming there to see the sights. If you're coming to Omaha, what are some things you landmarks that folks like Ciceronian Society attendees might want to see if they have the time?
So not everybody realizes that Malcolm X is from Omaha. He was raised here, which is not a, distinction for Omaha. We don't come out looking that good, but he has. There is a museum located at where his house stood, and some good culture and history built around the appreciation of his memory.
Yeah, and then right next to campus is the newly renovated Joslyn Art Museum. Beautiful pink marble building and a really nice collection as well. One of our colleagues was talking about how they've done a nice job of incorporating things that you'd see at a traditional art museum, but also a lot of the kind of Western and Native American art kind of integrated into their collection. And they just completed that renovation earlier this year. So that's certainly worth checking out and very close to Creighton's campus.
And there's also a castle, like a Joslyn Castle. Am I getting that right?
Yeah. Up on one of the ridges close, right outside of town, there was a big castle that was built, private home, but now is used for parties and events and things like that.
All right. Well, maybe if we get a major donation, we can schedule a hospitality suite at the castle. That'd be a very Ciceronian thing to do. Well, fantastic. We've talked about steaks, you said, and the Reuben. Is there any other food that y'all are known for? That if you come to Omaha, you got to have this, or you haven't been to Omaha.
Nebraska Cornhuskers fan, you're going to want to stop by and try a runza, which is a, I think it's like a, a German American answer to a burrito or something. Got cabbage and beef on it.
What in the
Yeah,
world
sort
is
of
that?
fast food thing now. So yeah, if you're, running off to the airport or something and need to grab a quick snack,
You
don't
get
have
a
time for the full steak and get a runza.
runza. That sounds like a euphemism for what you experience after eating it. That's fantastic. Yeah. I want to switch back now to the conference. So we're so excited to be coming to Omaha. This will be our first time there. It'll be my first time there unless I get to visit beforehand. But I really feel good about this location. I think it's going to be a great place to land for 2026. Of course, I never get the word right. Semisesquicentennial, semi. Anyways, 250th anniversary of Declaration of Independence. And I think a lot of folks are going to ask, like, why in the world are you going to Omaha? I was like, well, this is America, right? This is what we sought to be free to have this kind of life, this the independent pioneering life that I think the Midwest represents, and particularly this Omaha, known as kind of one of these points at which from whether pioneers set off or the stopping point, right? I mean, this is Lewis and Clark came through Omaha, right? Or what would eventually be Omaha, correct?
Yeah, that's the
Yeah,
Council
that's right.
Bluffs.
Oh yeah, Council Bluffs, because that's not where they didn't know they start in where do they start? I mean, technically they start in Pittsburgh, right? But
Yeah.
they eventually end up in, is it Independence, Missouri, or?
Well, when they got out here, they had to have the Lakota let them through the territory and safe passage. And so the young woman, Sacajawea, was able to get them in touch with the tribal leaders, and they had a council at the place where
That's why
they.
it's called Council Bluffs. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, that should be a great paper topic. There's also, I know this is also the birthplace of Gerald Ford, right?
Yes.
One of the presidents that we claim over here in Michigan, where I'm calling y'all from, but he was born there. Well, I want to come back to the conference. One of the things when people look at the Ciceronian Society, they think they primarily think the humanities, right? They think philosophy, political theory, literature, history, and all that's great. But why? And this is especially directed to Michael because you've been there at least twice now. Why would an economist, in your view, Michael, come to the Ciceronian Society conference? What has drawn you to it?
Well, as Colin was saying, we've ventured off into this area of humanomics, trying to figure out a little bit more of the source of variation among humans, right? Not just treating people as these homogeneous agents making the same choices. And so, as we've done that, I've gone to places like Acton University. So, for the same reasons that I was interested in Acton University, I'm interested in the Ciceronian Society, and I think Acton has been kind to the Ciceronian Society as well. Invited you guys to come there and present and have speakers. So I think that's a good way into thinking about why I would have been interested in the first place. And then Bob Subrick just sort of made a pretty direct statement that I needed to come and check it out. And we needed more economists. And I'm the kind of economist that answers those calls. So I went and presented a paper and had a really good reception, had some great questions. When I'm sitting in the audience listening to other people talk, I hear names like Philip Reeve and Peter Lawler, and I'm thought I was pretty well read, knowing who Eric Fogelin was, but now I'm learning things that I didn't even know I needed to learn. But all of those get to those same sorts of questions. How do you get to a society that can have order, form contracts, have exchange? And those are all of the questions that I think are informing our broader questions about who the agents are who are in these economic transactions. So I'm very interested in civil society and ways groups form and the sort of rules that they form for themselves and then and how they react to other rules and norms.
I think it gets to this point of the economics, and y'all can correct me if I'm wrong. I'm not an economist, but it is inherently or necessarily interdisciplinary, in the sense that because we are studying the behavior of human beings, and human beings as persons in the fullest sense, disciplines like history and literature, and philosophy inform how we understand that, and vice versa, right? The historian, I mean, how in the world do you understand what some of these things, why certain things happen historically without an understanding of economics, right? They feed off each other. And what I have found is that that interdisciplinary conversation just enriches the research and depth of the kind of questions that all of us are asking, whether we're in economics or philosophy or theology, or we're a classical educator, right? Or even if you're a pastor. I mean, you can't, a pastor or a priest is, you are embedded within an economy, within a society, and those kind of questions are crucial to who we are and what we're doing. Speaking of people who are embedded in all this, what are the chances that Warren Buffett will fund our evening hospitality? Any connections there while we're there?
He's not known for giving money to Catholic schools. He supports the public schools.
Yeah.
You know, you could add that as a his house is a visiting point for folks in town. You know, a lot of people drive by and see it. That's, you know, maybe more modest you'd expect given his means. Come Berkshire Hathaway weekend, you'll see very large crowds of people snapping photos of his house. So,
yeah, we'll invite him. We'll see what happens. We'll see what happens. I doubt he shows up, but, Warren, you're invited. This is your official invitation, from the executive director of, because I know you're listening. Anyways, now I want to close with this, just give you guys a chance, and we'll start with Colin. You know, what are some ways that listeners can learn more about the Menard Center, Creighton University in Omaha generally?
Yeah, absolutely. I can certainly follow us on social media, Menard Family Center for Economic Inquiry on LinkedIn or on Facebook. You could check out our website directly, which is creighton.edu/MCEI. And obviously reach out if you got questions for any of the affiliated faculty or for me. You know, shoot us an email. I think we've got a good collaborative group of people here that are willing to engage with other scholars and have conversations with them. So shoot us an email. And then hopefully this fall, we're planning on launching a podcast called Economic Inquiry, where our own Alexi Marcoux will interview some of the guests that we bring to campus for public talks and for colloquia. So that would be another way to kind of more directly connect with some of the program we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. Thank you guys so much. I'm really looking forward to coming there. And just for our listeners who, you know, if you're interested in getting more information ahead of the conference, and you have questions, you know, and you want to ask questions about Creighton or about Omaha or about where we're going specifically, these two gentlemen have been super helpful as we plan this conference, and I'll be in touch with them from now until March and beyond, and so I'm just so grateful. So thank you guys, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Josh.
Thank you.
Excellent.
Yeah, well, we're excited to have you on campus.
Excellent. You've been listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. If you've enjoyed this conversation, we hope you'll consider signing up for our newsletter and joining us for the 2026 conference in Omaha. As a reminder, paper and panel proposals are due September 1st, 2025, and we hope you'll consider joining us for what is always a great time. Also, as a reminder, nominations for the Herbert J. Storing Prize are also due on September 1. Be sure to rate and review this podcast, share it with your friends, and check out our website at ciceroniansociety.org. Now may the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, the love of God, and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with us all evermore. Thank you for listening.